When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Badatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, you stick around, I'll make it worth your while. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And, hey guys, I got a question for you.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Have you ever seen, it's kind of one of those cult classic type things. It's one of those science fiction cult classics. It's, Star Trek.
Star Trek, yes.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. That was the one with the Force, right?
Yeah. People would say live long and prosper, then the little gem in their hand would light up, and then they'd be chased down by replicants. I'm pretty sure that's how it went.
Where did Gandalf come in?
You know, everywhere he could. You could not keep him out. You tried and he'd be like, here I am. And we loved him for it. No, seriously, Star Trek. We're talking about warp drive today.
The time traveling police box.
Yeah. All right, we're done making terrible like meme mashups here. But no, we're going to talk about Star Trek and warp drive.
Yes.
Warp drive. So, you know, Star Trek was a space opera. It would span the entire Milky Way galaxy, more or less. You know, you've got these incredible, huge expanses of distance that you have to cover in order for you to have these adventures where the Enterprise, which was an exploration ship, could get from point A to point, you know, Z Delta Q47-M. And in order to do that, you had to figure out, well, how are we going to have a propulsion system for this ship that will allow for this amazing amount of travel?
Well, but Jonathan, there's no wind resistance in space. So couldn't you just continually accelerate? Like, you keep accelerating and you just keep going faster, right? There's nothing to slow you down.
There's this small problem called relativity.
Yeah, special relativity.
Special relativity. All right. Specifically. Yeah.
Let's talk about light here for a second. Okay, so in our universe, from what we understand, anything that has mass is limited by the speed of light. Nothing can go at the speed of light that has mass. Nothing can, definitely nothing can break through it from our side based upon what we know with special relativity. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't stuff that's moving faster than the speed of light that we just haven't detected yet. But we believe that there is an impossible barrier of the speed of light, and anything on one side of it, meaning anything slower than speed of light, can't go faster than that, and anything faster than speed of light can't go slower than that.
And how do we know that? Well, it's because we have this equation, E equals mc squared. You've heard it before, and it's a very well-tested equation. It's pretty much proven to be correct on the relativistic scale.
Yeah.
But the problem is, when you plug the numbers into that, you realize that if something with mass goes the speed of light, its mass would technically become infinite.
Now, I'm going to correct you.
Sorry.
That is a very common, statement, although it's not entirely correct. What we should say, instead of saying mass, we should think of it in terms of just energy.
Right.
All
right. The energy required to propel it would be infinite.
Exactly.
Exactly. The amount of energy you would need to propel that mass to the speed of light, let alone faster, would reach infinity, which means that you would not be able to do it. You cannot do it. At the same time, we have another thing that we have to take into account, time dilation, which is, from the perspective of an outside observer, time would start to slow down for anyone who is approaching the speed of light. And if they were to hit the speed of light, time would stop from the perspective of an outside observer. From your perspective, if you're the one traveling at that speed, everything's A-okay. Everything's normal.
Well, in fact, going close to the speed of light is an easy way to create a time machine, right? You can travel into the future.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can do that too, just by waiting around. I just let it happen.
Blistering speeds of 1 second per second.
You can travel faster than the things around you into the future, because for you, time slows down.
Right. Well, and it's only when you reach that frame of reference that the other observer is in, right? So, like, if you get in your rocket ship and you rocket off at near the speed of light, and I stay on Earth, to you, time is passing exactly as it would if you were anywhere else doing anything else anywhere.
Right.
To me, time is passing, based upon my own experience, exactly the same way. A second is a second to both of us. However, from my perspective, more time would be passing for me than it would be for you. And when you got back to Earth and we were to compare our timepieces, we would see that that's the kind of that's what reality would reflect.
I would arrive in your future.
I would be present.
You would be younger when you got back than Jonathan was comparatively.
Yeah. In other words, I would have aged more in that time.
Yes.
Because more time would have passed for me, less time would have passed for you.
And we can see that in things like satellites. There's what, like a 7 microsecond, I believe?
It's like
a lag of satellite clocks versus Earth clocks due to the speed with which they're going. Yeah. However,
and there's the relationship to the mass of Earth, right?
Yeah. There are two things you have to take into account, the masses and the speed. But yes, you are right. We have to throw in special little leap seconds every now and then to keep the clocks on track.
Mm-hmm.
So another interesting thing is that, so, you know, we talk about the speed of light being the maximum. So the maximum being speed of light through a vacuum, right? Like, mm-hmm. when there's nothing else there, because light will travel at different speeds through different media, right? If it goes through glass, it's a little slower. If it goes through water, it's a little different. But if it goes through a vacuum, that's supposed to be the fastest ever, period, right? Wrong. Did you guys see this? Scientists made light go faster than light. Do you know what I'm talking about? All right, this is pretty awesome. So at Princeton, we had some scientists, and you know, scientists, they get a little rowdy, just like anybody else. And you know, on a Friday night, things are a little slow in the lab. It's time to break some basic laws of physics. They actually created a little chamber of cesium vapor. And they put laser pulses through this chamber, and they were observing that the laser pulses were emerging from the end of the chamber before they had fully entered the other side of the chamber. So the laser pulses are shorter than the chamber actually is, and yet they were emerging before they could have already been all the way into it. How is this possible? How could they actually move faster than the speed of light? Well, it turns out, it's not actually breaking the laws of physics. It's not breaking special relativity from what we can tell. What seems to be happening there is that the information in the laser pulse is contained entirely in the very front end of the laser pulse. And as soon as it starts to enter in the chamber, it's actually generating a new laser pulse on the other side. So it's not the same laser pulse going into the front as it is coming out the back. It's kind of like if you were to have a set of twins and you have one twin positioned at the exit of this room and another twin starts to walk into one entrance just as the second twin goes out the exit. To you, it's like, how did that person cover that entire room instantaneously? They didn't. It's two people. In this case, it's two pulses, but it was a pulse that's generated because of the information contained in the beginning of that laser pulse.
Okay, well, why is this speed limit a problem if you want to explore the galaxy like they did in Star Trek? Well, let's take a look at the distances. What's the closest star to Earth?
The sun. It's 8 minutes away.
You got me there. What is the closest star to our solar system that is not the sun? Well, it's Proxima Centauri.
Yes, yes. And
it is 4.2 light years away.
Meaning that it takes 4.2 Earth years for light to travel from that star to us.
Right. So you make a good point that that is from the outside observer's perspective, not from the traveler's perspective. But let's say that you were going at the speed that it's not possible to go, the speed of light, as far as we know.
So we're
it would
on a,
still take, for, to an outside observer, a really long time for you to get there. I mean, just prohibitively long for really exploring the whole galaxy.
Right. From inside that ship, it wouldn't take 4.2 years, right?
That's right.
But to anyone else, it would take 4.2 years, and that's the closest star. So if we're talking about distant stars, one, it's still going to take you a long time to get there personally. It may take months for you to get to a distant star on a ship, even traveling at the speed of light. To an outside observer, it may take generations, depending upon how far away you're talking.
And even for you, if you're talking about really exploring the galaxy, like going to other quadrants, so they say, I mean, that's going to take a long time.
Yes.
At subliminal speeds.
Yes.
So can we do it? Is there a way that we could ever possibly go superliminal? Well, Star Trek had to explain it somehow. What did they say?
Well, they went with the warp drive approach, which is that
originally they were calling it a hyperdrive back in the original 1960s series. But then certainly by the end of that series and when Next Generation kicked up, they started using this warp field idea.
Yeah, talking about going at warp 2 or warp 4 or whatever. And you know, Star Wars stuck with hyperdrive, but the idea was that, well, Star Wars, they never explained it. It might as well just be magic in Star Wars. But in Star Trek,
it is magic.
Yeah,
so much is in Star Wars. In Star Trek, they attempt to explain it by saying that they generate a warp bubble around the ship, and that warp bubble actually warps space around it. And so if you were to think of space, you know, space-time is kind of this, think of it as almost like a fabric in a way. It's this three-dimensional and really four-dimensional fabric that is the stuff that our universe or at least our galaxy sits in. And things like gravity affect it and can distort it and change it in different ways. So if you were to try and travel from point A to point B, and it would normally take you 10 years of travel because of the distances involved, if you were to be able to warp those distances so that the distances were actually closer together, it would take you less time to get there. And you would have the benefit of not breaking special relativity in the process, because localized area, you're still going well below the speed of light.
You are in a little subspace bubble that is kind of magically created.
Right.
They didn't really get into the actual explanation of this until, I believe, Star Trek First Contact, which began development in 1994, the date of which is going to become important in just a moment.
Yeah. So the idea here is that we have, kind of like if you were to look at a map and you look at New York and you look at L.A. and you think, wow, it'd take a really long time. You know, you're just tracing your finger from New York to L.A. and following all the highways. And then you think, well, what if I just fold the map so that L.A.'s on top of New York? And now, boom, I'm magically there. That's more or less what we're talking about, except that it's not necessarily taking two points in space and folding all of space-time so that they are adjacent.
That would be more like a wormhole, which is a different concept of hyperspeed travel.
Yeah. This would be more like, let's try and crinkle space-time so that we can get it closer. And that way we're still traveling at relativistic speeds, but we're having less distance to cover.
More like riding a surfboard on a wave rather than trying to swim through it, or like moving on like standing on a moving sidewalk and walking rather than walking on, you know,
just
level
regular,
non-moving ground.
Yeah, non-moving ground, sure.
So in Star Trek, what they're precisely talking about doing, because you can always look into the science of Star Trek, they write a lot of books about it that are really fun, is using a matter-antimatter reaction to create a really energetic plasma, which is then channeled into warp coils that generate this warp field that form the subspace bubble that take you to, you know, planet Klingon.
Where do the Jeffries tubes come in? Those are my favorite. That's what you use to access the nacelles, right?
which come into that process somehow.
Right, yeah, that's where the warp field ends up emanating from the ship to end up surrounding it and then creating this warp drive.
Okay, so the ship itself isn't moving at superliminal speeds. It's riding a wave of space that's moving at superliminal speeds.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. I don't think it's going to come out exactly the way Star Trek did. I don't think we're going to come across dilithium crystals anytime soon. Those are what were supposed to generate the antimatter. But antimatter is a real thing. For those of you who don't know, antimatter is matter that would have an opposite charge of its counterpart in matter. So the electron has a negative charge. A positron would be the antimatter component. That would be the positively charged subatomic particle in the antimatter world. Antimatter and matter, when they meet, annihilate one another and release energy as a result. During the Big Bang, for reasons we don't fully understand, there was a little bit more matter than there was antimatter. And so those early reactions annihilated most of everything, and we had more matter left over, so that's why we've got matter in our universe. I would guess from a universe that had antimatter, maybe they would view theirs as the matter and ours would be the antimatter. Again, it's that frame of reference thing.
I believe this was explored in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon series with the neutrinos.
I'm sure it was. I'm not gonna even pause to acknowledge that any further. So
you already did.
Any further, I said. And now you made me do it again. You made me break my word. Anyway, so the matter-antimatter reactions could actually create enough energy, theoretically speaking, to create some form of warp bubble, according to certain theories. Nothing that we've been able to test out and actually say, yes, this is something that is actually possible. It's just hypothetical at the moment. But it would probably take a lot of it, like a seriously huge amount of antimatter. Because the antimatter that we've produced in things like the Large Hadron Collider, you're talking about minuscule amounts, not like something on the size of, say, Jupiter, which is what people first thought would be required to create a warp bubble of significant size to move something like a vessel from one point to another. Beyond that, being able to designate different levels of warp, because, you know, they had the warp 9 through warp 10, and then they eventually would, I think in the final episode of The Next Generation, the new version of the Enterprise goes like warp 14 or something, which doesn't make any sense because according to the mythology in the world, warp 10 was supposed to approach infinite speed. So I don't know how you go faster than infinite speed, but
what is infinite speed?
It's essentially supposed to be infinitely faster than the speed of light, because warp 9 was, I think, 1,900 times the speed of light.
I don't know.
I'm confused.
I'm betting that Keanu Reeves was involved, and I disapprove.
Yeah, well, no ship was supposed to be able to actually go warp 10. I think the upper limit on ships was supposed to be 9.65 or something. But of course, Star Trek, you know, establishes rules and then breaks them.
Okay, so Scotty aside, what have real scientists said about this?
Well, so 1994, we've got a Mexican physicist. His name is Miguel Alcubierre. And he proposed a method of stretching space. So you would stretch it in a wave, which would cause the fabric of space ahead of a spacecraft to contract and the space behind it to expand, thus propelling it kind of like in that surfboard-type fashion you were talking about, Lauren, so that you could move at from an outside perspective at superliminal speeds.
Right, but again, what we're saying is that the ship itself, relative to its reference frame, is not going faster than the speed of light. It's riding sort of a bubble or a wave of space that is going faster than the speed of light.
Right, right. So you're still maintaining special relativity. You're not breaking it in any way. You're not like physically traveling. It's not like someone is suddenly able to run faster than the speed of light. It's just that, again, let's say that you're doing the 100 meter dash and you're able to compress those 100 meters into 2 meters for you and you'd be able to cross that 100 meters in the same amount of time that normally take you to cross 2 meters. That's oversimplifying what this model would do, but it's a similar idea. It's this idea of being able to essentially compress space, and ride the super fast hyperspace warp bubble.
Right, but the problem here is still with fuel, because what Miguel was saying, Alcubierre was saying that you would potentially need more energy than what's contained in the entire universe in order to get this engine started.
Yeah, and then there were others who said that even if you fiddled with it a little bit, you might be able to get it down to a matter-antimatter reaction to provide the energy for generating this hypothetical warp bubble. As far as we know, this is just hypothetical. Right. We may not ever be able to do it.
Well, I think what he showed is that it's theoretically consistent. The problem is just practical,
right?
That it's not like that. This doesn't make sense. What it is that the idea makes sense. It like could technically work. You just need this stuff that we don't know if you could really make.
Right. And antimatter was just one of the examples of something that could give power. In fact, he was talking more about if you were able to find matter that has negative mass.
Right.
All right. So I'm going to blow you guys' minds here for a second. Negative mass. All right.
Negative mass.
So negative mass would be like, imagine it's, I can't really imagine this, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. Imagine that you have an object that has -2 kilograms of mass.
Okay.
So instead of having 2 kilograms of mass, it's -2 kilograms of mass. Now, with simple equations, for example, force equals mass times acceleration. If you take that negative factor in there and you multiply that by an acceleration and to get the force, you're going to get an interesting result. So for example, it would mean that if I had an object with negative mass and I were to push it, it would move in the opposite direction of the force applied to it. So Joe, if you had negative mass and I pushed you,
I would go into your hand.
Yes, you would move into me. And that would be a very awkward thing, and we'd have to go see HR. But
or on a larger scale, like a negative moon and a negative Earth, if you could imagine such things, would repel each other instead of attracting each other gravitationally.
It would also be a little odd because when you have negative mass, the electromagnetic force that holds it together would be a destructive force rather than because anything that pulls it together would actually push it apart. Let me ask you this. All right. So you've got negative mass. Let's say that I have a negative mass object that I've suspended somehow. Don't ask me how yet.
Warp bubble.
But then it drops. I let go of it. What happens to it?
It goes up.
No, it does not go up.
Oh.
It actually falls. And the reason why it falls is because while we call gravity a force, it's actually it's actually acceleration. It's not really a force in the sense of the basic forces of thermodynamic law. It's an acceleration. It would still fall. However, because an object that has negative mass would go in the opposite direction of where you placed force. You know, if I put an object on top of a table, technically the table is pressing up at a level of force that's equal to keeping that object on the table. Well, if an object with negative mass goes in the same direction as whatever force you apply to it, it happens to be, that means you'd have to put a negative mass object underneath a table and let go, and the table would keep it from falling. But if you were to remove that table, then it would fall. And once it hit the ground, because the ground would be providing force pushing up, and because the object would want to go in the same direction as where the force is coming from, it would start to either disintegrate or burrow into the surface of the Earth, not stopping until it got to the center.
Just kill me now.
Okay, you wanted to know about it.
Right. This is the kind of stuff. Matter like this is what physicists might call exotic matter.
Yes.
Right.
It's stuff that in a lot of cases we don't really have any way of knowing that this exists.
Right.
But you can make sense of it mathematically.
Right. You can make a mathematical argument for it, but or, we don't have any actual practical evidence of it.
I would put quotation marks around sense in that particular application, but theories about this go back to the 1950s, and were kind of revamped and applied to conceptual engines in the 1980s, which probably is what led us to our fancy Star Trek kind of concepts.
Right. Right. But so technically, if you could get your hands on a whole bunch of this exotic matter that we're not sure exists, you could maybe create this warp drive.
Possibly,
because if you get two objects that the masses of which cancel out, then the interactions between them could create a constant acceleration in the direction of the positive mass, wherein their momentum and energy would remain canceled out.
I'm going to just nod because at some point I just started imagining candy bars in the middle of that sentence.
That's probably safer for everybody.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Let me say something else. So let's say that we were able to create a warp drive. That doesn't even assuming that that's even possible. And there are people working on it right now. NASA's got folks working right now trying to see if this is actually a possibility.
Whoa! Don't just breeze past that. NASA is working on warp drive.
Well, they're looking at least the feasibility of
working might be a strong word.
Yeah, I wouldn't say building a warp drive. I'd say checking to see if the science or at least the hypothesis can be reflected in reality.
Yeah, you wouldn't say working on it as in like they're building one. You'd say they're doing research on it. They've devoted at least one, $50,000 interferometer to this research.
Right. Mm-hmm. To see if it is at all possible to generate a warp bubble in the first place. But, I was going to say that even if we were able to make a warp drive like tomorrow and we were able to build a ship that could in fact warp space around it, there are some other potential issues, one of which is that there's some people who think that it's possible such a device would create such a huge level of Hawking radiation that we would all die if we were to ride inside a spacecraft.
That would be bad.
Yeah, there's also some people who suggest that the deceleration process, while perfectly fine for everybody who's on board, assuming that we're still okay from the Hawking radiation, could be somewhat destructive at the destination.
Yeah, there's this idea that, say, a bubble of space moving through space around it at these superliminal speeds would sort of collect charged particles that are flying through space at super high energy as it moved along.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just kind of like carry them along in its pocket until you stop.
And then release them.
Yeah.
Oh, right, because those particles don't have brakes the way that the ship does. And so, you know, suddenly your bubble stops, your ship stops, the particles keep going and destroy the solar system.
Right, yeah. So as you're flying along, you're just collecting ammunition that will immediately be launched out in a cone of death in front of you wherever you stop.
My bad. it's kind of how I am. Everything I touch, I destroy.
Well, just the point is, if we get this drive working, you'd want to, like, I don't know, park around the block.
Right, you don't want to don't pull right up to where you're going. Yeah.
And there's still a little bit of an energy problem because even this NASA team, which is being led by a Harold Sunny White, is saying that the system would work on about like the annual energy consumption of the United States, which is smaller than that Jupiter thing that we were talking about earlier.
I think they said that the amount of antimatter they would need would be about the size of the Voyager spacecraft as opposed to Jupiter.
Right.
Which is,
well,
you know, that's significantly smaller. Yeah. Yeah. It's still we're still running into that huge problem of how do you supply enough energy. In fact, that was one of the interesting things at howstuffworks.com. If you read how warp speed works, which John Fuller wrote a few years ago.
Aww.
I sat next to John and I gave him helpful hints and he still didn't include my bit about the Jeffrey Stubbs. but anyway, he had asked me a couple of questions as he was working on this article. He actually did some research and found that scientists were talking about how impractical it would be because a ship the size of the Enterprise would require a certain amount of energy in order to move just at impulse speeds. Impulse is like it's slower than the speed of light. It's pretty fast, but as I recall, it's less than warp one. So, but impulse drive would be would be enough to require more energy than what the Enterprise could feasibly supply, let alone the energy you would need to fuel a warp drive, propulsion system. So, that seems to still be well within the realms of science fiction. So even if we were able to prove that this is a possibility from an actual, being able to really create a warp bubble, like that's actually a thing we could do. It may not be something we can practically do as a means of transportation.
At the same time, while we want to be careful not to overhype, we also shouldn't laugh this off. I mean, I encourage this research.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, if nothing else, it teaches us more about how space-time itself is constructed, right? And it may tell us more about things like the conditions the universe was in the instant after the Big Bang. You know, that will be amazing stuff to learn, you know, just from making observations through this kind of stuff. And who knows, maybe there is some way we can harness this in a way to either have communications or transportation in some future implementation. It would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
As long as we don't, you know, blow up whatever it is we're trying to call.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Yeah. That NASA research team is talking about trying to implement this on the quantum level, as, you know, many things are talked about being implemented in this kind of theoretical physics. But even that, if they could pull something like that off, of creating a warp bubble of quantum particles in the next few years, that's terrific.
Yeah. Not to beat a dead horse, but we keep revisiting this idea. Go 100 years back and show them all the technology we have now. It is magic.
They burned it at the stake.
It is just unthinkable magic.
Yeah. Yep, yep. Well, heck, I mean, if I just have a conversation with some of my extended family members, they think that I've harnessed some sort of weird magical power. But, I grew up in rural Georgia. So, all right. Well, do you guys have anything else you want to say about warp drive before we sign off into the sunset?
That's all I got.
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to
wrap me up.
Let's wrap up warp. So guys, that's it. Make sure you go and visit our website, fwthinking.com. That's where we have all the videos and blog posts and articles that you can peruse and enjoy. There's some amazing stuff on there. I highly recommend you go check that out. And remember, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Our handle is fwthinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new, season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.